Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
Greetings and welcome to the ID the Future podcast. I'm Casey Luskin, broadcasting from Discovery Institute Center for Science and Culture in Seattle, Washington. This podcast will give a response to the recent YouTube challenge to the Discovery Institute, and I've titled this response, "Does Any Critic Out There Understand Intelligent Design?" Any critic making the inaccurate claim that Stephen Meyer is the, quote, president of the Discovery Institute, unquote, is bound to be fairly uninformed about both intelligent design and the Discovery Institute. Thus, when I recently viewed a YouTube video making this very mistake while allegedly, quote, challenging the Discovery Institute to discover, unquote, I first thought, why should I accept a challenge from someone who can't even correctly discover the identity of our organization's president? Regardless, this video that recently appeared on YouTube was enlightening, but not in the way that its authors intended. Rather than posing any difficult challenge for ID, the video unwittingly exposes the unfortunate ignorance that apparently abounds regarding the nature of the theory of intelligent design and how we detect design and test for it in nature. In this regard, I view this response to the video as an opportunity, hopefully a teachable moment, for the 40,000 plus people who have apparently viewed the video on YouTube and the handful who have emailed us regarding it. That is, it's a teachable moment for those who are interested in learning. The basic problem with the video is that its challenge woefully misunderstands intelligent design and the logic by which we infer design. It claims that ID only claims that a gene is, quote, unambiguously designed, unquote, when we find that, quote, 1, no homology for other genes exists, or 2, no alternative or prior function exists, unquote. Each criterion makes an extremely poor test of ID, for design structures often appear in similar forms in different designs, and design structures can also have multiple functions. Let's examine these two contrived criteria in turn. Firstly, why must design structures be unique? Regarding this first criterion, the homology criterion, the video claims that homology is found with at least 20% sequence identity over at least 100 amino acids, which would have an odds of less than 1 in 10 to the 28th of happening by chance. There's actually much debate about what constitutes homology and what a non-arbitrary measure of homology should look like. For example, Teichmann and Vita, in their 2004 paper in Genetics, suggest that homology should not be inferred when there is less than a 60% sequence identity. If this is to be the measuring line, then many claims of protein homology, including the claims in this video, would be in jeopardy. But for the sake of argument, we'll take the video's definition of homology. The video's argument effectively says that a gene must lack any known homolog and thereby be completely unique, basically an orphan gene, in order for us to claim that it was designed. But why must this be so? The video's first criterion for detecting design seems eminently contrived and unreasonable as a test. As I explained in my recent primer on the Tree of Life, designers commonly reuse similar components in different designs because they are effective at performing a common function. As I wrote, quote, why not consider the possibility that biological similarity is instead the result of common design? After all, designers regularly reuse parts, programs, or components that work in different designs, such as using wheels on both cars and airplanes, or keyboards on both computers and cell phones, unquote. In this regard, we might actually expect to find similar proteins and genetic components among living organisms if life were designed. If there is no known homology for a given gene, then that would dictate that the gene is effectively an orphan gene. The existence of orphan genes poses a problem for evolution, for from whence would such an orphan gene come? But the non-existence of orphan genes does not pose a problem for ID. After all, many critics are quick to remind that evidence against evolution does not necessarily therefore constitute evidence for ID. ID, after all, requires a positive case for design. Thus, these ID critics are testing ID inappropriately by trying to affirm ID simply by challenging evolution. When it comes to predictions about biological similarity, both common design and common descent predict that it might exist. Thus, the presence of shared functionally similar sequences between different organisms does not make a good test of discriminating between design and descent. Even leading evolutionists like Francis Collins recognize this point. Collins writes in The Language of God that genetic similarity, quote, alone does not, of course, prove a common ancestor, unquote. And that's because a designer could have, quote, used successful design principles over and over again, unquote. Collins is right. To show how the video's argument fails by analogy, if one discovers two Buicks in a junkyard, one would not conclude that one car descended from the other. Rather, one would conclude that intelligent engineers modified plans from the first Buick to make the second. In the same way, the genetic similarity of two different proteins in itself is compatible with either common descent or common design. So rather than failing to make a case unambiguously for intelligent design, homology fails to make a case unambiguously for common descent. Ignoring the possibility of common design, the video assumes that shared functional similarity necessarily indicates common ancestry. This video is simply applying what I called in my recent primer on the tree of life, the main assumption of neo-Darwinian tree building. As I wrote, quote, "The first assumption that goes into tree building is the basic assumption that similarity between different organisms is the result of inheritance from a common ancestor. That is, except for when it isn't. And then the similarity is purportedly said to be the result of convergent evolution, etc. But even if we take this claim at face value, that similarity between different organisms is the result of inheritance from a common ancestor, let's recognize it for what it is, a mere assumption. But are there other possibilities?" Unquote. As for those other possibilities, Michael Behe explains in both The Edge of Evolution and Darwin's Black Box that mere similarity is not enough to infer that a feature was produced by the neo-Darwinian mechanism of natural selection acting upon random mutations. As he states in Darwin's Black Box, quote, "Although useful for determining lines of descent, comparing sequences cannot show how a complex biochemical system achieved its function, the question that most concerns us in this book. By way of analogy, the instruction manuals for two different models of computer put out by the same company might have many identical words, sentences, and even paragraphs, suggesting a common ancestry. Perhaps the same author wrote both manuals. But comparing the sequences of letters in the instruction manuals will never tell us if a computer can be produced step by step starting from a typewriter. Like the sequence analysts, I believe the evidence strongly supports common descent, but the root question remains unanswered. What has caused complex systems to form?" Unquote. Or as Behe wrote in The Edge of Evolution, quote, "Modern Darwinists point to evidence of common descent and erroneously assume it to be evidence of the power of random mutation." Unquote. These critics in the video are thus mistaking sequence similarity as evidence for the neo-Darwinian mechanism of natural selection acting on random mutations. I would go even further than Behe and argue that when we consider the possibility of common design, functional similarity, i.e. sequence homology, does not even provide unambiguous evidence of common descent over common design. After all, to reiterate what Francis Collins admits, genetic similarity alone does not, of course, prove a common ancestor, because a designer could have used successful design principles over and over again. Now on to criterion number 2, repeating Ken Miller's errors. When you only read the arguments of critics, sometimes you begin to think that they have the monopoly on a subject. This must be the case for the YouTube video's creators, who mimic Ken Miller's strawman test for irreducible complexity by stating, quote, "We don't want some protein that is used lots of ways or it can't be part of an irreducibly complex system," unquote. What? These guys must be learning about ID from Ken Miller and not from ID's proponents. Miller has made similar arguments like this many times, misrepresenting intelligent design, and I wrote a lengthy response to Miller on this point in 2006 in an article titled, "Do Car Engines Run on Lugnuts? A Response to Ken Miller and Judge Jones' Straw Tests of Irreducible Complexity for the Bacterial Flagellum." To repeat Miller's assertion, he testified during the Dover trial that irreducible complexity is refuted if one subsystem can perform some other function in the cell. Miller stated, quote, "Dr. Behe's prediction is that the parts of any irreducibly complex system should have no useful function. Therefore, we ought to be able to take the bacterial flagellum, for example, break its parts down, and discover that none of the parts are good for anything except for when they're assembled in a flagellum," unquote. The question becomes, how is Behe's argument for irreducible complexity different from that of Ken Miller's and this video? Behe actually formulates irreducible complexity as a test of building the entire system. Irreducible complexity operates on a collection of parts, not each individual part. Behe discusses and defines irreducible complexity as follows in his book Darwin's Black Box, writing, quote, "In The Origin of Species, Darwin stated, quote, if it could be demonstrated that any complex organ existed, which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down," unquote. A system which meets Darwin's criterion is one which exhibits irreducible complexity. By irreducible complexity, I mean a single system composed of several well-matched interacting parts that contribute to the basic function, wherein the removal of any one of the parts causes the system to effectively cease functioning, unquote. Thus, according to Darwin, evolution requires that a system, including its subparts, be functional along each small step of their evolution of the final system. If this were the case, then the complexity of a system would easily be reducible. Yet, one could find a subpart that could be useful outside of the final system, and yet the total system would still face many points along an evolutionary pathway where it could not remain functional along numerous successive slight modifications that would be necessary for its gradual evolution. In other words, subparts could perform other functions outside the final system, but the system itself could still be irreducibly complex. Thus, Miller and the video challenge mischaracterize Behe's argument as one which focuses on the non-functionality of subparts, when in fact Behe's argument actually focuses on the ability of the entire system to assemble, even if subparts can have functions outside of the final system. Two analogies will help explain the fallacy in the video. To understand how Miller and the video's test fails to accurately apply Behe's formulation of irreducible complexity, consider the example of a car engine and a bolt. Car engines use various kinds of bolts, and a bolt could be seen as a small subpart or subsystem of a car engine. Under Miller's logic, if a vital bolt in my car's engine might also perform some other function, perhaps serving as a lug nut, then it should follow that my car's entire engine system is not irreducibly complex. Such an argument is obviously fallacious. In assessing whether an engine is irreducibly complex, one must focus on the function of the engine itself, not the possible function of some subpart that may operate elsewhere. Of course, a bolt out of my engine could serve some other purpose in my car. However, this observation does not explain how many complex parts, such as pistons, cylinders, camshafts, valves, the crankshaft, spark plugs, the distributor cap, and wiring, etc., came together in the appropriate configuration to make a functional car engine. Even if all of these parts could perform some other function in the car, which is doubtful, how are these parts assembled properly to construct a functional engine? The answer requires intelligent design. All these parts are necessary in my engine in order for it to function, and that's why it's irreducibly complex. Behe asserts that a system is irreducibly complex if the system stops functioning upon the removal of any one part. This is the appropriate test of Darwin's theory, because it asks the question, is there a minimal level of complexity which is required for functionality of this system? Clearly, my car's engine has a core set of parts necessary in order for it to function. The ability of an engine bolt to also serve as a lug nut does not refute the irreducibly complex nature of the arrangement of parts necessary for the final engine system in my car to be functional. Behe never suggests that subsystems or subparts are not allowed to play some other role in the cell. In fact, he suggests precisely the opposite. Rather, Behe simply argues that evolution requires that the total system must be built in a slight step-by-step fashion where each step is functional. When a certain core number of parts must be arranged in a particular pattern for a system to function, we have irreducible complexity, period, regardless of whether some of those subparts could also perform other functions. To offer another brief analogy, my laptop's power cord might be able to also power my toaster. But does that mean that my laptop does not have a core number of parts that are required for it to function? You can answer that question for yourself. The video's second criterion for detecting design is therefore also utterly fallacious. Finally, we'll answer the challenge, and it challenged critics to understand intelligent design. The video then claims that, quote, you, being Discovery Institute, have not pointed to a single gene that shows evidence of a non-evolutionary design, unquote, saying that we haven't discovered. To restate the obvious, apparently these critics simply aren't familiar with Discovery Institute or ID literature. In Darwin's Black Box, Michael Behe has described many systems with dozens of genes which, as they form irreducibly complex systems, show evidence of not having been produced by natural selection acting on random mutations and instead show evidence of design. Molecular biologist Doug Axe's research likewise studies genes that it turns out show great evidence of design. Axe studied the sensitivities of protein function to mutations. In these mutational sensitivity tests, Dr. Axe mutated certain amino acids in various proteins or studied the differences between similar proteins to see how mutations or changes affected their ability to function properly. He found that protein function was highly sensitive to mutation and that proteins are not very tolerant to changes in their amino acid sequences. In other words, when you mutate, tweak, or change these proteins slightly, they stopped working. In one of his papers, he concludes that, quote, functional folds require highly extraordinary sequences, unquote, and that functional protein folds, quote, may be as low as 1 in 10 to the 77th power, unquote. The extreme unlikelihood of finding functional proteins has important implications for intelligent design. Since Darwinian evolution only preserves biological structures that confer a functional advantage, this data indicates it would be very difficult for such a blind mechanism to produce functional protein folds. This research also shows that there are high levels of specified complexity in enzymes, a hallmark indicator of intelligent design. Only forward-thinking intelligent agents could find the extremely unlikely amino acid sequences that yield functional proteins. Axe himself has confirmed that this study adds to the evidence for intelligent design, stating, quote, "In the 2004 paper, I reported experimental data used to put a number on the rarity of sequences expected to form working enzymes. The figure reported is less than 1 in a trillion, 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 trillion. Again, yes, this finding does seem to call into question the adequacy of chance, and that certainly adds to the case for intelligent design," unquote. If Axe's empirical studies are correct, then enzymes likely sit atop a virtual vertical peak of their fitness landscape, which are isolated in a sea of low-function or non-function possibilities within sequence space. In other words, there are extremely high levels of complex and specified information in proteins, informational sequences that would be highly unlikely to be found via blind trial-and-error processes of Darwinian evolution. This points to intelligent design. The video taunts Discovery Institute to name a specific gene that shows evidence of design. At the risk of dignifying this highly misinformed video, some of the enzymes empirically studied in Dr. Axe's work were those containing beta-lactamase domains in E. coli bacteria, such as the TEM1 penicillinase. So Discovery Institute and ID proponents most certainly have described genes that show evidence of a non-Darwinian and intelligent design. We've simply done it through a viable mode of detecting design, finding biological systems that contain high levels of specified complexity or irreducible complexity. This is the proper way we detect design and test for design, not inventing contrived criteria to claim that systems must be totally unique and perform only one function before they can be designed. Given that designers regularly reuse parts that work in different designs, and may even use a part to perform multiple functions, we can easily dispense with the video's uninformed modes of detecting design. The video opens by showing Stephen Meyer arguing that, quote, "When we find information in the DNA in this four-character digital code, it's a logical inference and explanation to say that an intelligent agent played some kind of a role in the origin of these living systems," unquote. The video then challenges Meyer and Discovery Institute to provide evidence backing this statement, which is amusing since there will be no better elaboration on the scientific case for intelligent design based upon the information in DNA than Dr. Meyer's forthcoming book, The Signature in the Cell, DNA and the Evidence for Intelligent Design. This book comes out next month, and therefore the right question, which the book answers, is where does your information come from? Obviously, these videos' creators are not getting their information from proponents of intelligent design. Stephen C. Meyer, however, has elegantly explained that we know only one source of high levels of complex and specified information, stating, quote, "We have repeated experience of rational and conscious agents, in particular ourselves, generating or causing increases in complex and specified information, both in the form of sequence-specific lines of code and in the form of hierarchically arranged systems of parts. Our experience-based knowledge of information flow confirms that systems with large amounts of specified complexity, especially codes and languages, invariably originate from an intelligent source, from a mind or personal agent," unquote. For those critics willing to read it, Meyer's forthcoming book, Signature in the Cell, will more than answer the video's challenge. I'm Casey Luskin, wondering if any critic out there understands intelligent design. Anyone? Anyone?
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute, 2008. For more information, visit www.intelligentdesign.org or www.idthefuture.com.